Okay, I'm here with Brian Taylor. This is Bob Dobbs, and this is our second response to activities on Alex Couscous's Marshall McLuhan forum on Facebook. And this is an appropriate time for us to get together and talk because Brian witnessed the latest presentation by the McLuhan Coach House or something connected to that. So what was it you saw last night, Brian?
It was one of the McLuhan salons that Paolo Granata has been organizing, and a really good one, a great, very, very astute topic. It was about Videodrome. The title was, I think, The Digital Unconscious in Videodrome, and because the movie Videodrome by David Cronenberg is, you know, I mean, clearly, I guess, obviously, it's pretty much the number one most McLuhan-relevant movie on the nose that way, because McLuhan is one of the main characters, basically, or a McLuhan proxy, a version of McLuhan, is one of the main characters. So it was, I'd never seen the movie on the big screen, and it was certainly fantastic to watch it, but also a panel discussion about Videodrome and McLuhan, which, what could be better than that? So I was definitely very, very much looking forward to it.
And what kind of crowd turned out?
The place was full, as far as I know. I mean, Nigel and I were in the second last row, and it was full. The row was full. The row in front of us was full. As far as I could tell, pretty much every seat in the place was taken, and that's about 200 people at least.
Okay. Is that the biggest crowd you've seen at a salon event?
Well, the last one had quite a sizable crowd as well. I'd say comparable in the... get the name of the auditorium at the Toronto Reference Library. Maybe not quite as many. A slightly different layout of crowd, kind of hard to estimate, but yeah, they've had good crowds. I was a little surprised at the crowd at the last one, and I guess some people really come out to see these people who are heads or former heads of successful software companies. Because I was thinking, oh, I'm coming to the McLuhan Salon with the woman who wrote this book about Anonymous. And I thought there'd be, you know, 50 people, 60 people. But this guy from Mozilla, I think, probably brought in the bulk of the crowd.
When I see pictures of that crowd and other salon things, tend to be gray-haired people, older people. Was that the case last night?
No, I think last night had a lot more... 30-somethings and 20-somethings. The people beside me were younger than me.
Oh, okay. Okay, so...
I mean, Videodrome has become a pretty popular... The thing is, the one panelist, Anna... Sorry, I forget her
Thane,
last name already.
Thane.
Anna Thane. She teaches a film class and other classes at McGill, and she says she always begins her class on Canadian film with Videodrome, and that it's very popular. Students always respond to it well, that it's aged really well. Mm. So it makes sense that a free screening of Videodrome on the big screen would attract a decent crowd, especially the talking about it in terms of McLuhan.
Right. So I don't know Thane, but I met Catherine Richards at Banff in Severo Latrenje's conference on the 25th anniversary of postmodern theory in December 97, and I gave a presentation and it featured my tiny note chart, which I just put together a year or so before, and she was the only person who wanted to discuss it after. She came up to me and said, let's go into it. So we sat down and I explained the chart for a while, so that's how I remember her, but I don't know what happened in her career. So what did she, was it an argument between Thane and Richards, or
it was Janine Marchessault gave some introductory remarks and then would ask questions of both of them or raise a theme, lob a theme at them and get point counterpoint or just other points, and then once they had something to say, then they'd move on to a new topic. So no, it wasn't an argument or a debate. And they were, yeah, it was more scattershot in terms of their what people weren't arguing a thesis. They were just saying some stuff
about what they liked about it, why it was significant.
Yeah, it was definitely, unfortunately, it was, well, except for the introductory remarks, Jeanine Marchessault quoted, gave a few McLuhan quotes, and was, I mean, her introductory remarks were about McLuhan themes and relating it somewhat to Videodrome anyway, but unfortunately, the panelists' comments were much, much more about Videodrome than about McLuhan.
Now, if this is the McLuhan Salon sponsoring this?
Yes. So, yeah, there's a big, big picture of McLuhan sitting beside the stage the whole time.
Oh, so are people supposed to talk about McLuhan? Not necessarily, or...
I don't think that they were really breaking the rules by not talking about McLuhan, but then again, there's some sort of, I guess, tacit feeling that if you're talking about new media, you're talking about McLuhan, which
right.
is I wouldn't agree with,
right.
but it's not good enough, especially not for Videodrome, which is, I mean, it's don't want to seem to say that it was at all bad, because it wasn't. The things being said were interesting. It was good. But for someone who is, I am laden with significance of that movie and McLuhan and you, and, you know, there's many ways and very interesting ways to explore that were, as far as I know, totally untapped.
Hmm.
So that it was frustrating for me. It was a tragic missed opportunity to have all these people there and not really have a discussion about Videodrome and McLuhan. But it was not bad in any way. And I mean, it was free and it was a great idea. Like I'm really, you know, I think so far at least my experience of these McLuhan salons is that Paolo's doing a good job. But I didn't really think the panelists did a good enough job for me. They said some interesting things, but there were some... say, it's frustrating when Catherine, right?
Yeah.
Catherine Richards? Yeah.
Yes.
When she mentioned the helmet, famous helmet, that is the cameo where briefly, apparently in the shot, it's David Cronenberg wearing the helmet instead of James Woods. Mentioning this wonderful helmet and using that to seeg into talking about virtual reality stuff, and that in at that time that was pretty ahead of the curve for talking about virtual reality. You know, it wasn't a buzz topic for another 10 years in the San Francisco kind of scene.
Yeah.
But then again, completely missing and not mentioning the point that in the movie that helmet is a recording device. It's not it's for recording hallucinations. It's not for broadcasting a virtual reality experience to the person wearing the helmet.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that basically kind of summed up the experience of the night. Like, it was an interesting point about the sort of film. But it's more about the film. Like, Videodrome was a little ahead of its time with this VR helmet.
So it says in the blurb, it will explore techno-surrealism. Was that done?
Yes. The actually, that would be, I kind of forgot that surrealism was the other topic that they related it to much more than to McLuhan. Both of them, I mean, again, it's like, you know, at a certain point it's a matter of taste. Like, I had just reread, actually, just earlier this month, reread Salvador Dali's fantastic essay, The Conquest of the Irrational.
Yeah.
And so, and one of the things he specifically dismisses in that essay as an example of the type of surrealism that we've seen a lot of recently, that I'm pretty sure its time has come to an end and the real surrealism is going elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things he mentioned was the fur-lined teacups. And both panelists named that as their very favorite surrealist object or surrealist work. And I don't hate the fur-lined teacup, but it's definitely not something that opens up onto more things to say
right.
about surrealism, and especially not techno-surrealism. The fur-lined teacup, I don't know, like that. No, they were relating it to a media type of thing, and just not in the way that I would like. You know, like, again, I'm trying to just underline this. It's not that it was bad, but it was definitely not the McLuhan Falon about Videodrome that I would have liked to hear. But let's see, about the
surrealism. What did Dali say about the fur-lined teacup? He said that's the proper archetype of a movement.
No. What he was saying about the fur-lined teacup was that it was a type of the fur-lined teacup and the sort of random juxtaposition surrealism.
Yeah.
A frenzied random juxtaposition sort of thing, and impossibilities was kind of has had its day, and that was sort of a brief exploratory thing, but that's not really where the action is at with surrealism.
So Dali cites the one that doesn't make it anymore, and he wrote that, what, in the 50s, that essay? Do you know when he wrote it?
Maybe the 40s. No, 50s sounds about right.
Right.
Or so 60s, I don't know.
He's saying that doesn't work, and the panelists were citing what doesn't work by the 50s as relevant to Videodrome. Yeah, that's your point there.
Right, and to me it also just, I don't know, I guess it's more like I said, that I don't know. To me, the fur-lined teacup is not something that you can really say very much about.
Right.
But techno-surrealism and the digital unconscious is, well, that's not the only avenue that was, just that they both cited it as their great favorite surrealist example, but I was kind of astonished. But anyway, the...
So listen to this. So they say the prescient aspects of the film are surveillance, mediatic augmentation, hacking, the continuity between culture and nature. Did you hear any of that discussed?
Yes, and that's kind of a problem, I would say, because surveillance, I don't really see how that's an overarching theme of the movie. I mean, I don't know how you don't put the phrase, regardless of whether you take it as a film trope or a real-world technology of the CIA, I don't know how you don't put the phrase mind control there as one of the major themes of that movie.
Right.
And to me, that's when I say there are so many avenues that you could usefully, the myth of mind control technology, and that, how do you take a McLuhan, did McLuhan say anything? He said lots about surveillance is the point. McLuhan said lots about surveillance. So, you know, Jeanine Marsh so offered a quote about it, not the cooler take today ones. I don't remember which one, but, you know, they talk, but mind control and that question and possibilities and how it's presented in Videodrome and the idea that, as like any technology, there's a good use for it, and Bianca does a sort of a good guy version of mind control, that the idea that the McLuhan character developed it or helped to create it, that's a juicy topic that is completely left on the table. I have to say that I missed 10 minutes of the panel discussion, so there could have been something great in there that I missed.
Oh, you arrived late.
Well... No. I didn't arrive late. Basically, if there had been a 10-minute intermission between the panel discussion and the film, I wouldn't have missed it. But it's not really their fault. I understand why you're going to put the... It would have been better to have the discussion after the film, for my taste, but then, of course, you would have had most of the people leaving, probably.
Right.
But it would have made it hard to talk about, I don't know, surveillance as a major theme of the movie right after you'd seen it, I'd say.
So Jeanine, do you remember any quote she gave when she cited McLuhan?
I should, and I did, and I'm pretending that she went first, and then we watched the movie. She brought up, she was bringing up the theme, she talked about Hans Sale and McLuhan being friends with him and applying the idea of the numbing at the sight of the action of the new technology. It was a long quote about that she brought up. And that is a really good quote and very interesting. And I don't really know how that process or that quote really applies in Videodrome exactly, but not in the same way that I would say about surveillance. I just feel more like that is actually a good question. But I don't know if it was really explored properly. I mean, there are things in that movie such as the character Harlan protests that, "I'm not just your servo mechanism, Patron," you know, which is like, that's a, you know, that's a McLuhan word that he would use. So, so it's, you know, that seems like the kind of thing that you would mention when you're talking about the McLuhan salon of Videodrome. It's just other things were mentioned, I guess, that were interesting. They just, it just didn't seem really like a McLuhan salon.
Well, when you take in this little statement aspects of the film, including surveillance, interesting quote by by McLuhan on surveillance is that everybody engages in daily espionage. Everybody, the information society, is surveilling of each other. So you can move it out of the top-down paranoia to another kind of collective surveillance, which is even more, and he said that 50 years ago, maybe even in the 50s, but it is a cliché archetype. But, of course, that's the stuff in that he would have said 5-6 years before. So, Tom, 50 years ago, and I guess the Android meme has provided everybody to obviously be involved in surveillance and actually create their own intelligence agency with their Facebook postings. So, something like
that. Yeah, and I mean, in Videodrome, there's some, it would be more of a voyeurism than surveillance, though, exactly, would be more the appropriate.
Yeah, theme. See, that's not really appropriate, but that is an important theme from McLuhan if you're going to say surveillance. Then mediatic augmentation, that says nothing. I mean, what mediatic?
But I think that might have been the very quote that she used, because now that I'm thinking about it, when she was talking about surveillance, I'm pretty sure that she used a quote or just said along the lines of this, everybody's surveilling everybody.
Right, okay.
That was the take.
And, you know, for the younger kids in the Facebook millennial generation, they should be made aware of what McLuhan was saying 50 years ago. And that should make them say, well, how this guy got it right? How did he do that? And then hacking, I would say that's McLuhan. I find that McLuhan makes broad statements that applies to the general effect of all media since McLuhan. So hacking, he's never described that, but he said all there is left to do is to dance on each other's toes. That can be fit into hacking, you know? That's hacking's a subset of dancing on each other's toes. That's important. Like, we're all one little membrane, and all we can do is
dancing in each other's foot lockers.
Yeah, and then that would then be misinterpreted as trolling. Hey, buddy, stop trolling me. Well, I'm not trolling. We're in the same spot. Chicken and egg, can't tell the difference. I'll make my move, you make your move. You know, we're not trolling. So, anyways, that would be a way. I'm looking at ways to say, what did McLuhan say that applies to today that people should be impressed with? The continuity between culture and nature, that seems to be...
Yeah, I don't know. Again, I have no idea what they mean for Videodrome. And there's a problem with saying hacking. To me, there's a real problem with associating hacking with Videodrome, which is that none of the technology is digital that they use. Like Harlan, it's an analog, he pirates. Well, no, he said it was a scrambler, so I guess there's some hacking involved. But that's not, it's not a computer-based hacking of some other computer. He's using more, like, I guess there's some digital. It's not just electric analog. There is electronic and a bit of digital in there, but it's really not hacking what Harlan is doing to get the Videodrome signal. And to say that the Videodrome signal is hacking people's brains is a pretty arbitrary pick of just an invasive adjective. So, like, that to me, that's another, like, it sounds like that was written by someone who maybe didn't even see Videodrome.
Okay, so I saw Videodrome in the early 80s, and it's 1981 approximately it came out.
83.
And I certainly noticed, I mean, not everybody back then would notice the McLuhan connections. You might have had to be an older person in the 60s and known about McLuhan.
Right.
And then the reference, he has his daughter, then you have to know about Terry McLuhan, who made movies. So I was not impressed with the movie at the time.
No.
And I kept checking up on Cronenberg through the years, looking at interviews by him to see what would he say about McLuhan. And eventually, 10 years ago, some collection came out, and he did say some things about McLuhan. And I always thought when I start around the 70s when he became his first horror movies, he started to get attention. I recognized him, and in some way, and since I'm the person who attended the McLuhan Monday Night Seminars the most of anybody alive today, I mean Barry Nevitt attended them from '64 till McLuhan's passing. That's 16 years. He definitely did attend more than me, but he's not alive, apparently.
Right.
So of the people alive, I even attended more than Eric, because Eric was away in those era in the 70s, different points,
right,
be it living in another part of the country. So so being the longest there, and I have a pretty good, I have a keen memory of faces. One face sticks out that I used to notice, a regular attender. And then when I saw Cronenberg, I said, oh, that looks like the guy that I used to see there. So,
Yeah?
Yeah, he may have been, and this, if you ever see him, ask him if he attended the
I certainly would.
Yeah, the Monday Night Things, because there was a guy there that was a regular around 1976 that I remember, and I didn't know him, didn't talk to him, but he looked, in my memory, when Cronenberg became a face I was familiar with, he was that guy. So,
okay. So
I don't know how much he was a student of McLuhan, but he attracts attention because he's not doing hot, cool McLuhan cliches. He's starting to pick up virtual reality. So for those that come in later with virtual reality in the 90s, he's the closest back there. And McLuhan is like a side part, even though, is he talking about McLuhan, the main character?
What was this idea that's in the movie, they have the cathode ray mission, where the idea that what these father's derelicts, she says, what these derelicts need, or homeless people, what they need is to plug into the world's mixing board and, you know, watch some TV as if it's a soup kitchen for TV, basically. And I kind of, you know, that's an interesting idea. To me, that totally sounds like something McLuhan might, an idea he might toss off, whether it's actually in print somewhere or if it was just overheard at some Monday night seminar that, you know, it's almost like almost a five bodies-ish, a TV body-ish sort of idea that, like, yes, you know, they need to feed their stomachs, but they need to feed their other stomach too.
Right, but McLuhan always insisted that you didn't need to own a TV to be involved with the TV environment. So you were saying that this was a service for homeless people? Is that what you're
saying? I'm wondering if this idea of the cathode ray, if you're saying that you think Cronenberg was at a bunch or some anyway Monday Night Seminars, I wonder if this idea of the cathode ray mission of homeless people, you know, obviously it wasn't McLuhan's mission to do that, but if this idea was anywhere in McLuhan, or if it was, it sounds like something that could have been picked up at an idea that the director got at a Monday Night Seminar. I always thought that I wondered if this cathode ray mission was a real McLuhan idea.
That's what, at the time, I thought Cronenberg was following along with an erroneous image of McLuhan. Not that he had to be McLuhan, but it supported the bad news about McLuhan, which McLuhan was suffering at that time. It made McLuhan big. Remember, the guy was a huckster and a savvy commercial guy or something, a sinister guy. Then his daughter takes over or something? Is that what happened?
Yeah, it's his daughter is running the mission and also can basically hiding his death and enabling him to continue to appear on television on video.
Yeah, now when McLuhan had his stroke in September 79, it was not announced for 5-6 months. It was a hidden. I was privy to what the secret was through Mark Stewart, his McLuhan's secretary, and we weren't allowed to talk about McLuhan. Nobody was to say what was happening. Now, Cronenberg might have known Terry McLuhan because she was in the film business in the 70s, and maybe they knew each other, and that's why he brings in the daughter aspect rather than Eric. And he might have thought there was some kind of, he might have been in touch enough to say, wait a minute, nobody's telling us about McLuhan, until then all of a sudden he's dead. He might have been on the scene in Toronto, and because there was a bit of a cover-up, he knew it. he knew about it somehow, and that's why he projected that onto the character. But I don't. You see, it's always the Don Thiel's objection to Tom Wolfe is looking at the way the brain can be taken over with neurological devices. That biological view of McLuhan is really limited. McLuhan
right.
was talking. What people don't understand is how he was talking about why a movie like Cronenberg's movie would show up, how the culture, other media were affected by, at that point, that would be the instant replay, the global theater, the satellite communications, and cable TV. They were the new thing. So how are they affecting other media, other art forms, like movies, books, hockey? That's what McLuhan was analyzing, not about, we're going to lose our brains. He said that we were robots since the printing press. So everybody's worrying about the cyborg. He did an essay.
Right.
In the
60s. Yeah, the whole mind control idea, that's the thing. I mean, in a way, you understand why, because at a certain point, if you start really talking about McLuhan in relation to things, it can kind of let the air out of things sometimes.
You mean that's good?
Well, I mean, it's a good thing to do, but in the sense of
You mean take away the paranoia?
Yeah, just like if you were going to bring up the idea of McLuhan and mind control or something, then you would tend to be undermining the idea.
Right. So what was I going to say there? The interaction of me. So that part of McLuhan where he was. He says he did an essay in the mid-60s on the cyborg, one of the early people to talk mm-hmm. about that word and use that word, and he said we've been cyborg for 500 years. Now, that's a pretty interesting, radical diffusing of the paranoia about cyborg, you know, what's that magazine, Mondo 2000, or any of the paranoia, even Walter Bowert. I used to chide Walter Bowert. He's the one who started the mind control meme. In the late 70s. And he, remember, attended the last Monday night seminar. He was the last speaker, the last guest.
All right.
I thought in December 1979, McLuhan was already not able to attend. But the thing is, I like the way McLuhan would take, you know, science fiction themes and move them to a whole other level. Like, what? We've been cyborg for 500 years. What are we now? You know,
yeah.
If we've been cyborg. Well, then you get, he says, well, we're the planet of the dead. We're not even here, you know.
Right, yes. He would definitely tend to, the science fiction did not outdo McLuhan.
That's right. He actually, he used to consider Finnegan's Wake a closet Finnegan's science fiction, and Wyndham Lewis wrote science fiction. So he would always be in any environment to the conventional notions of what science fiction was. And so he's going to diffuse science fiction or whatever anybody's... It's almost like you make a big deal out of something that's not Finnegan's Wake, you're going to get beat up by McLuhan.
Right.
You fail to mention Finnegan's Wake, you're out of here, buddy. You're history.
Well, the thing is, I mean, maybe the figure of McLuhan, the character, McLuhan-ish character in Videodrome might not be the fairest or best McLuhan proxy, or like you say, that it kind of plays up a huckster slash. He also was, he's the good, him and Bianca are the good guy. Him and his daughters him and his daughter are the good guys in the story, but he also co-developed the Videodrome mind control technology, and
right.
they use it as well. But so it's a little more sinister that way, but there are other, there are other elements in the film that are very, very astute, and I mean, one is particularly obvious. But you know, I mean, it's too bad to hear that you said you didn't like it, and you've always seemed at least to not be very familiar with it. Because I mean, if I was a subgenius, I would have assumed that, or I would have maybe even accused you of stealing from that movie, and that, I made a discovery in the subgenius science of decoding Bob's larceny. He stole his Android meme AP thing from
right.
the Videodrome, the New Flesh, Videodrome versus the New Flesh. But there's another point in it that
that's a good point. Let me just point. I've always made a point to say, no, that stuff is not impressive. I see Cronenberg, or most.
It o- it only sounds like it. It only resembles it in the words. The ideas are not similar to the Android meme and the new and the AP.
No, but like Cronenberg, what I would object to is that a movie can't show what's really going on, but a sentence can. And so McLuhan's sentences were better than the Terminator movies and everything else that they've been running
with. That bridges right, and that's a good point, that bridges right into the next thing I was going to say, which was what I noticed watching it last night in terms of your something influence you could have gotten it or he could have gotten from you. I mean, I used to assume that Videodrome came out that he had been influenced by you on the radio. But anyway, one of the things, an interesting line right near the beginning, this would have been a good tangent to talk about in a McLuhan related to Videodrome way that's pretty sort of simple, which is, you know, Max, the main, he's like Moses Neimer or whatever he runs.
Yes, definitely
Civic,
Moses Neimer.
Civic TV instead of City TV.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, he's looking for new material, right? He's on the hunt for good, juicy stuff.
Yeah.
And he's generally looking for softcore porn, but it's all about, in his interactions with two people where he's dissatisfied with the stuff what they're presenting to him isn't really good enough, one of them objects, like, oh, you can't fast forward to the end. You won't know what's happening. And he's like, please. Like, my viewers do not care. They want to see your tits, right? And then the other woman is woman is offering him some softcore porn to buy and broadcast, hopefully, is something that's more plotless. But it's like a Greek, like, or a Roman, orgy scene. I guess it's just some endless orgy or something. And but anyway, that's a setup for the fact that when he discovers the Videodrome thing, he's looking at it for the first time. Harlan is showing it to him, and he's like, "What happens? Like, nothing. This happens. This keeps happening." He's like, "We never leave this room." And I thought that line is that it sort of comes up later with. Professor Oblivion never leaves his room.
Right.
It's kind of a theme that comes up later, but that reminds me of, you know, we're running on the same spot,
yes,
sort of thing. But in terms of a narrative, in the terms of, like, video coming into its own, rather than having TV or having to have movies as their content, which has novels as their content,
right.
That having no narrative development at all, just you're in this one room.
Yeah, that's the laser beam effect. You think of that quote on the deck. The audience's intellect is scrapped on the deck.
Right.
You know that what we brought up last time. But
the laser beam will use the content of human dreams and the
human intellect.
The audience's intellect off the court deck.
But good. But we'll scrub it, but
and
good.
They will be scrubbed, but good.
Yeah. Okay, so that's 1968. As you talk about being in the room, that is Finnegan's Wake. You see, what's the point of a university if it's not supposed to uphold literate values and humanist values? That's what they're supposed to do. Now, they've been on the defensive for 30, 50 years as new media took over. But if you're a professor of media, the most important part of McLuhan is to say, wait a minute, this thing of being trapped in a room, that's Finnegan's Wake. Then you tell the young people, what? That science fiction theme is in Finnegan's Wake? This guy wrote this in the 30s? That attracts people to the book. And that way you're preserving literate culture is the thing. But I find that none of the McLuhanites know anything about literature on that level and do not do that role. They just end up talking with humanist values about later media that undermine humanist values. So it's a lost cause. So like you say, they talk about, Catherine and Thane talk about maybe mediatic augmentation, continuity between culture and nature. No, why not make McLuhan be a semi-cult about it? Say, look, there's nothing that's happened in the last 40 years that McLuhan didn't cover or imply, or we're just sitting inside the bigger view he had. If you're going to be a McLuhan salon, you got to talk about McLuhan. And that is considered an academia, anti-academic. You can't emphasize one person. Well, if you're going to not be an academia and have a public thing like a McLuhan salon, really rub it into people's faces how McLuhan whoops all of you people out there. You know?
Yeah.
And that's what you mean.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah. That's what you're saying you missed. You missed that in when you go to these seminars. So
well, that's what I would like to see, and I guess that would be the seminar that I would run.
Yeah, yeah, you could do that.
I would hope to, I mean, if I was going to set up, I would guess I would want you on it, but maybe you don't like video drone enough. But,
I don't need to see a movie to, I mean, I would just read reviews and then figure out an idea from the review, because if you have a real broad McLuhan view, you can fit anything into it, especially if you've got the Finnegan's Wake aspect.
You should probably take another look at that movie, though, but
yeah,
I'd like to know what you thought of it.
Well,
but,
how about this? I know that McLuhan and I've posted it on the Alex's forum like last year, 8 months ago, is the great section in an essay McLuhan wrote in 1957 for, I think, Canadian Forum magazine on subliminal advertising. And he talks about cranial wall plugs. You probably remember that quote when I posted it. He talks exactly about the Cronenberg Videodrome MK Ultra technologies that were coming in 1957, and he has a very unique take on it, showing that it's not as bad as people worry about. You know, the paranoia factor is not so much in his statement, other than you'd be appalled maybe back then that you had the plugs put in your skull, cranial wall plugs. But he covered up. He dealt with that whole. You know, whatever they thought virtual reality would do to people, he did it in 57. That's the kind of acknowledgement of McLuhan, that he is trying to warn people about that, but he comes up with an interesting take on sort of moving around it.
And what's interesting is that he comes up with a take that's more, when the question is, what is it going to do to you? McLuhan comes out more with a take of, like, what is it going to be like to be you? Rather than what is it going to look like?
Yeah,
like what is your situation going to look like as if a camera was looking at you?
Right.
It's going to be more like, how is your sensibility mutated?
Well, and that would be still a subplot, because it's about what will English teachers have to teach? What would movies be like with this new stuff? What would all the other media and politics, not just media, entertainment, politics, war, sport, social behaviors, what would they do? That's especially what kind of avant-garde activity in the arts would come out. That's what he was predicting, and that's never talked about. We tend to, which could be now, you could say that the North American is a gadget lover. It's as McLuhan said, the kids worship trains, cars, and planes. That's what's poetry to them when you grow up in North America, where it's back in the 50s, would be more books in Europe. They didn't have this, vehicular kind of media around them. So, what was I going to say about that? So, in North America, we're machine gadget lovers more than the rest of the world. And so, we are projecting, when understanding McLuhan or understanding Finney's Wake, we're projecting our gadget lover bias always. That's what Tom Wolfe did. He took the neurological effects of new media, and I do this interview with Leon Surrett a couple of years ago, who was a student of McLuhan in the classroom in 62. Do you remember that commercial in the 90s of McLuhan discovering medium is the massage or medium is the message, and it's a Heritage commercial?
Yeah, I remember.
And he discovers it. It shows him in class. And he suddenly discovers it and says it to the students, and the students are blown away. You remember that's the commercial or the ad? Well, Leon Surrett would have been the kid in that classroom, because in 61, 62, as a student at the University of Toronto, his buddies would discuss, is this guy nuts? What is he talking about? And they were shocked that 2 or 3 years later he became famous. You know, and they just thought he was an eccentric professor. But Leon Surrett is very impressed with neurological research. It was something, and you hear it in the interview, he points out that McLuhan has been proven right, that whatever the neurological research that was discovered a couple of years ago, that made Leon not be so cynical about McLuhan. He rewrote, reappraised McLuhan because of that biological, neurological factor that is so tiny in the levels that McLuhan dealt with. So even Leon Surrett.
Right.
And then I started saying some medium as message, basic McLuhan ideas. And he said, "What are you saying? That's nuts."
You
probably heard that dialogue, right? You remember?
Yes. Well, yes.
At the end, I was playing McLuhan back to him, and he thought that I was crazy what I was saying. Yet he had thought McLuhan had been proven right with some new scientific discovery. So. That would be the North American bias, right? American interpreting McLuhan.
Right, and that gets totally to the heart of what you would imagine, like if you were going to raise this issue of mind control as presented in the movie or in the general mythos, whether journalistic mythos or movie mythos, and you're going to try to relay what would McLuhan say about it, because we don't think he really did say anything explicitly about it. You would have to go towards the private citadel of consciousness.
Yeah.
Which is the way that you, in your diaries, I love it. It's like you could say something about MKUltra, or you could write a scene where you are telling off the director of the program why their shit is not going to work. I love that. But that you're saying that it's a really good point, the way you put it, that and in the MKUltra modern mythos of this guy from Toronto who claims to be a victim, this is an important point of his story too, which is that you are never what you have yourself saying to Sidney Gottlieb, I think.
Yes.
Is you are never going to know. It's like, oh, you're never going to crack that private citadel of consciousness, right? Because the point is, in Videodrome, he sets it up at the beginning. He's dissatisfied with what everybody's offering. He's like, I want something harder that'll break through.
Yeah.
He says they want it to break through. And so it's the whole movie is about this myth of the video that'll break through the screen and break through your internal screen and really affect you.
Yeah.
So, like, the thing is that the way you said it was that, like, oh, you'll never break through the private citadel of consciousness. Oh, you can disorient it for a while, but you will never know when it has recovered the ability to distort what it's presenting you.
Right, right.
And that's a really important point, and that get this whole hardware, gadget lover, neuroscience thing just takes for granted that there is no private citadel of consciousness.
Yeah.
That if you steamroll the brain lobe, then it will respond, you know?
And that is the eternal question around McLuhanism. McLuhan, when you tell him that quote from Counterblast, they'll say, oh, that's his Catholic faith, that the soul or something deep in humans that's eternal, media can't affect. Well, the ongoing drama today is, well, maybe that won't hold up. And so McLuhan, he oscillated between, yep, well, we can't have the phonetic alphabet infecting us anymore. That's not going to work. So we can't be Christians on that level. So where are we? Is there a new spirituality going to come out of this? And he treaded the question. But he had to acknowledge the side that said, you can't go to the citadel of consciousness. You know what I mean? That's where.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take that view, then life is a comedy. Because you have all these people running around pretending they're being affected, and they're not. That was McLuhan's, one of his Menippean angles, the comedy, which would come from Wyndham Lewis, that kind of view. But I don't think McLuhan would 100% say that could hold up forever. See, that would bring in how deep is his faith. You know, because he did worry about something happening to humans. And he called him Planet of the Dead. So how much is what he concerned about, the collective communication, social communication, and the individual integrity? So that's an ongoing question about McLuhan and what he was working with. That's why I'll bring it up. You know, you get people reading McLuhan and they start thinking they're massaged by this media and that media and they're just robots. And then you tell them, oh, by the way, media don't affect you individually. They do not affect what? I thought it was all about it. I was a visually biased person, now an acoustic biased, and McLuhan threw that wrench in the work there. Had to be said just to get you not too involved in what you think.
Well, it's
going to do to him.
It really helps to have had some sort of epiphany where you psychedelic or otherwise, where you realize that that your identity is artificial and constructed out of language, and it's a different thing than the real you.
Yeah, the real you can notice that.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The deep you. So the deep state.
The deep you is a way better way of saying it than the real you, and that's totally funny resonance to the deep state.
Yeah, totally,
because you elect a new identity every once in a while, but you've got this deep you that is way more powerful, that totally manipulates the stupid surface ego identity.
Right.
With the like, oh, yeah, that's why you did that thing, for sure. Keep telling yourself that.
Right. Now, that is a really important part of McLuhan's knowledge, awareness, and satire, is that the way somehow collectivity takes over the individual deep you, and you have to operate in the social, what he called it, the fictitious illusions. It's like redundant in one of his 1953 essays. Forget it now. Contrived illusions. Now, you have an illusion. What's a contrived illusion? Well, I'm going to delude you, but it's a fake delude. Fake illusion. Now, I can do better ones on you, but you're so weak, I can just use a fake illusion and you'll fall for it.
Yeah.
So, yes, contrived illusions and fake identities, I think, is the phrase. That's in one of those either Wyndham Lewis or James Joyce essays, 1953, in the Interior Landscape. But the to look at the confusion of the public media, and the public is a literate phrase, but media spaces, sociality, and then people getting lost in that, that is what the question is of what McLuhan's concerns were. And if you have that idea that people are faking being deluded, but they can't stop it because the group mind, the group users of a medium, all fall for it.
Right.
That's difficult to speak through and speak around, which all novelists and artists try to do, but pretty hard to bypass the medium as you're using it.
Pretty hard, yeah.
This is what I think of. In 1975, I was at in East Village at the famous Poetry Church, St. Mark's on the Bowery. You ever been there? Where the bring everybody and used to do poetry in that church on 10th Street?
I believe I have walked past it.
Yeah, 10th Street and 2nd. So I was there on March 7th, 1975. The Americans had just left Vietnam a week before the Colossus of Saigon. And there was Paul Krasner and Ken Kesey, two icons of the counterculture. They'd come to town, and they had to sort of, what do we do now? The Vietnam War's over. What's our enemy now? And so one of them said, I remember the story of the king and his population and his constituency, and everybody goes mad. But just before everybody goes mad, he gets one other guy, an assistant or something, to have a secret communication signal. So as everybody's nuts, the king would look for the guy who knew that signal. I can't remember what it was. You know what I mean? Then he'd know that guy was not subject to the madness that was going on.
There
was one guy that was, by those two being connected with their secret signal, then they would overcome the madness and then they could do something about it or something.
Mm-hmm.
So then Ken Kesey says, I used to believe that that the aliens were real, and now I believe that they were created by the CIA. Then Paul Krasner says, I used to think the CIA made the aliens. Now I think they're just CIA. In other words, Ken, if I said it right, Ken and Krasner had opposite views and switched over to the other opposite view and remained opposite to each other.
Right.
You get that? So Kesey believed there were aliens. Krasner didn't. Now Krasner believed as a result.
Kesey now doesn't.
Yeah, he thought it was CIA. Krasner, being an ex-employee of Mad Magazine and and the realist and a populist cynic, he knew aliens were a product of the CIA. Now he believed there were aliens.
Right. That's really cool. That's really, and it was really funny because as you were saying that, I thought you were going to say, You said Ken Kesey said, "I used to believe aliens were real, but now I believe they're created by the CIA." And then I thought you were going to say Paul Krassman said, "I used to believe the CIA was real, but no."
Yeah, I don't know where you were leading with that, but you thought they would be on the same page.
I thought it was going somewhere else.
Oh, okay.
That's a funny flip around. But that's astute too for the question of, well, what's our new enemy? Because in the middle '70s to the mid late '70s was the CIA, like the church community,
right.
Where you're gonna just find out what it's doing to you.
Yes, and Ginsberg went after several poets came out of that. St. Mark's and Bowery, they became like Mae Brussel, really pissed off at the CIA in the late '70s and did their art around that theme. But the so here's Kesey and Krasner. They're the king. You could say Krasner's the king, or in some people, Kesey was the king with the Merry Prankster. So the king and his sidekick, okay?
Right.
They had a secret signal for 15 years that would keep them in touch with each other, besides everybody else lost their heads. But they could not agree anymore on reality. They still knew each other. They still found each other out of the maddening crowd, but they had switched. Anyways,
right.
That's a pretty neat scenario. For me, iconography of cultural icons and what they had to go through. And
definitely.
It's interesting. Are those things probably wouldn't even be an issue with the millennials? I don't know what's an issue for them. You know what I mean?
I've actually read a couple of essays about whatever happened to UFOs?
Yeah,
that way. And there is, I think people are more interested. They've gone back into a more contacting aliens internally.
Yes.
Kind of a vibe.
You could almost say that again. The audience intellects got self scrubbed so much that the kids are not concerned about reality, authority, titillation. They're so inside the matrix that is what McLuhan was predicting.
That's interesting, because then McLuhan, it would make sense for our new fad of that was actually mentioned last night at the panel. This new fad thought of that we live in a simulated reality, like a matrix type of thing designed by some alien civilization. I guess that's the millennials are not so much interested in seeing a UFO visitor in a spaceship vehicle arriving as they are interested in detecting the traces of an ancient alien influence in our reality or something.
In our what? What's the last word?
In the architecture of our reality.
Right. They actually have their audience agent intellect erased. Millennials act like people with no audience intellect. Maybe that's what it is. So pretty soon they're going to say, where was the Matrix? What happened to the fear of the Matrix and all that? I don't think these millennials worry about the Matrix.
Yeah,
I don't know what. Apparently, you can't stop worrying. That's the one constant in consciousness, at least for most of humanity's experience. So, what are millennials worrying about today? What would be their concern? Does anybody is what's on the surface? What is Miley Cyrus concerned about? What is Katy Perry? What are they worried about?
I guess if you're asking, just what is it? What is the ostensible answer in the Android meme A-list or something, I guess, social justice?
Right, but I just realized what? They don't, like you say, it's all inside. They're all inside the world. They're inside themselves.
Yeah.
They don't like an ugly face like Donald Trump. That's what outrages them. You've ruined the decor of my inner space, my room that I never can leave.
Yeah. Yeah, the room that you can't ever leave has this guy on every day. Exactly. It's more
aesthetics. It's aesthetic.
Yeah, they're plenty. They're pissed off enough just by having to look at him all the time.
They do not want dirt in their environment. Video dirt with imagery with the wrong frequency or the wrong association. So they. That's interesting. We might have a breakthrough here. Brian, everybody is outraged at the image that's invaded their little room. And so the president has to be. So McLuhan used to say you had to be charismatic, and he defined it as looking like a lot of people. I don't know if that's what you got to be, but you've got to be a certain kind of aesthetic image based on years of watching recent TV shows and fashion models. If the president is not that, you can be outraged. So then the social justice guys, they're throwbacks to the people who still think they're outside the room, still think there's chemical bodies and physical bodies, and they're trying to have some kind of fairness or repayment for the period before the audience intellect was wiped off the deck. They want reparations for African-Americans, that kind of stuff.
For lost potential identities.
Right, so there's the dilemma. Lost contrived
identity. I'm thinking, what's exactly the new angle of this then? Because the idea of people kind of voting on a level of, I don't want to have to see that face for 8 years or 4 years, so I'll vote for the other one. That's not necessarily a brand new thing, but I mean, the outrage at having to see the Trump also has something to do with the coverage being so negative and literally alarmist.
It's not the people. The millennials don't exist. If the baby boomers live mythically, McLuhan said, then certainly there are no millennials. It's the Android meme pissed off at its own aesthetic. I forgot.
Right.
It's one part of the Android meme complaining about the other part.
The Android meme doesn't want to have to be ritually insulted every day.
That's right. And, especially someone who is trying to go around the Android meme. Censor it. Kick it out of the room. You can't ask
some
questions.
Someone knows at it.
Yeah. So let's see. So another thing is the justice warriors are those that do not regard media as important. They do not affect your citizen of consciousness. So they have the eternal humanist or... I don't know, basic human decency issues of, hey...
Really? No, but that's the thing, is that I thought it would be more that these, the whole trigger warning crowd or whatever is based on this idea that we don't have enough of a separation or a detachment from anything that comes over the media.
Oh, okay.
Traumatic, then it traumatizes us directly.
Yeah, so how much detachment? So I was just projecting this pattern that the millennials have become the cyborg, and they don't even care that their private citadel has been eroded, invaded, and scraped. But those that run around with old chemical body social justice ideas, they don't agree it's the planet of the dead. They just say, well, one-third of the planet is alive and two-thirds are dead because the two-thirds dead people can't overcome the oppressors. So those are those are chemical. So I'm just saying that leans toward media not affecting the citadel of consciousness. And the citadel of consciousness has eternal issues like justice and equality and less work week or something, less slavery. So the drama... Yeah. Of the question of whether McLuhan was upset, it was going to all wipe out the soul or not, is being acted out between the social justice warriors, their version, versus the millennial person just staring at their smartphone all day long.
That's interesting.
And clicking, maybe clicking a couple of social justice sites. Isn't that what you see the older guys complain about the young kids who think activism is just liking some petition, just clicking on something. That's all you have to do. Okay, so we may have ransacked this movie thing. Is there anything else? So when you walked out, or did you say you walked out?
I was alluding to the fact that we needed a smoke before the movie. So because there wasn't, we didn't want to come back in walking past people in the first 5 minutes of the movie. It was becoming apparent that the panel, like Janine Marchessault had, but that the panelists were not really going to be bringing much of a McLuhan spin on things. So,
so we
just ducked out for the last 10 minutes of it.
Well, so we made it the way it should have been in the past hour. We've brought the McLuhan elements into what Videodrome could have been about if Cronenberg knew his McLuhan better.
Well, I think it's pretty good. I think you might want to watch it again. But,
right. Well, yeah, I don't know what.
Well, okay. One other thing that, that.
How do I
said,
come into it? What part of me is in there?
Well, there's that. Good question, Bob. The there's that new Flash Videodrome.
Yeah.
APAM thing and being stuck in one room thing. Let's see. Well, okay. What I was just about to say was there's a kind of family against the corporation thing.
Yeah.
Like there's the Spectacular Optical people want to use the technology, but they say that when Professor Oblivion. When he realized what his colleagues wanted to use it for, he tried to shut it down, and they killed him. So the idea of co-developing something, and then you've got the power of the evil corporation that wants to misuse it, and once they bump off the inventor guy, that the only thing you have left really to fight that is the loyalty of family, to fight that loyalty of
okay,
the
now
corporation.
So since media was shrinking since the 70s, and then it really takes off with the digital 90s technology. And you know my theme is that the anthropomorphic physical, not the citadel of consciousness, though some might think it is, but the basic essence of what humans think they are starts to feel bigger than media.
Right.
And then that brings in maybe neoconservatism and the rights of the family values that the right wing, the Tea Party, represent over media, over the East and West Coast corporate machine that sucks their kids into the sin of the media world.
Right.
So now I'm saying that Videodrome is an anticipator of the AP over the AM.
Right.
I can look at it that way to fit it in.
Well, it certainly could because, you know, Bianca Oblivion she deploys a version of Videodrome that appears to, you know, help. Like, she kind of, it's like she turns Max as a programmed assassin, she turns him to her own ends to go assassinate the other guy. But it appears the way the movie ends is pretty ambiguous, but it kind of appears that Bianca Oblivion gave him an assassin program that he would go kill the other guy, but then the program would self-destruct rather than the usual, and then you go kill yourself.
Right.
So there's kind of a vibe of the good guy version of it, doing the good guy thing.
So this,
on the side of the McLuhans.
Right. The McLuhan Catholicism?
The McLuhan proxy characters in the movie.
Oh, okay. So in the 50s, as TV, the Beehive took over, you had movies like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. So then 30 years later, we're now, people aren't being taken over by media. Media is shrinking, becoming more user-friendly, not the huge environments of the first half of the 20th century. So the new impulse is to somehow resist the corporate Beehive. Or consuming of you, eating you. So not that movie's about media taking you over, TV taking over. That happened in the 50s. It's about recognizing we don't want to be taken over and we can fight it. That would move into the digital media world because digital media allows people to go around the big corporate machine. And now that is the president's image. He's fighting the corporate media monster. That's his opposition, which is incredible for a politician, a president to be fighting on that level, because the president always was an extension of the media, and it supported its image.
And having the means to talk directly to everybody via Twitter is kind of an essential part of it.
So we end me saying my ending is Videodrome is not about McClone, it's about Donald Trump. Trump is that guy. Because
that's good actually. I can
you could use that.
I can endorse that.
You could use that. Yeah. I can endorse it. So what it is the drama is Trump going to survive assassination? You know, how long can Trump be outraging supposedly everybody and not get wiped off the map, not politically?
Yeah, when are the deep state finally going to stop fucking around and pull out the classic, the nuclear option? As
blow up Trump Tower. And,
well, man, that'd be something.
Yeah, Videodrome, Cronenberg's a pessimist. He predicted, he wagered that Trump wouldn't succeed because the McLuhan character died. He was wiped out. So we'll have to send an email to Cronenberg to say, we've reevaluated your movie. You were so prescient. This will be the Northrop Frye salon.
Well, I mean, there was that, the thing, you know, the idea is that that's part of the whole mythos of the mind control, right?
Yeah.
You send a mind-controlled patsy to kill the president. So, but I remember one of these articles you posted at some point asked this unthinkable question that's, can you imagine the approval ratings of a president who greases his own potential assassin on live TV? You'd mentioned, I think Trump carries a gun. Like, Trump is packing, I think, and he's got private security. Like, can you imagine that, how the approval, like, how anyway,
you mean if he
can
if
you
he
imagine how dramatic that would be?
Yeah, you're saying if he caught the assassin and killed the assassin before he was killed, is that what you're saying?
Yeah
Well, that would be wide earp. That what would that be? That'd be Superman. That would be every James Bond.
That would be like the software bomb.
Yeah
That'd be the greatest thing that ever happened, like, on the world stage.
Right. It may be, that's interesting, because some of my friends, personal, very close friends, predict that Trump's going to be as president as long as he wants, because nobody's going to want the job. Well, and then he'll be put on Mount Rushmore. He may pay for it himself, but he'll be able to put himself up there.
That's hilarious, because I've heard this Mount Rushmore thing like a dozen times.
Yeah, yeah.
And then so putting that there, he might pay for it himself. Perfect.
Right, or he'll redesign Mount Rushmore, move it to Florida or something.
But, right, or he's going to buy it. He'll buy it and put it on myself.
Right.
I decide.
Yes, but I'm saying that something like you just proposed would put him there as a candidate for Mount Rushmore if he offered the assassin. I mean, remember the guy, and when he was campaigning, someone started attacking him from behind and running, leaped the fence and ran towards him, and he heard the crowd yelling, so he turns around and he gets to
that watch. Was an interesting moment. You got to see Trump, react.
Yeah, did he keep his cool, or did he leap back a bit? I can't remember what he did.
He didn't leap back. He looked he kind of held the podium at first.
Right.
And I think maybe people responded to that fact that he definitely gave a startled, alarmed, jerky movement, but he literally held his ground
there
with his hands in the first second anyway.
That's right.
So that's something.
Yeah, that could have been the meter, the charisma factor that started it. That, what is it, critical mass, because he is ready to fight the guy if the guy gets to the stage.
Yeah, he didn't just immediately duck and cover or anything. And he kind of got a, like, fierce, like, okay, here's, like, a, like, oh, no, I have to go into the zone. Kind of a look on his face, more than a panic, oh, no, kind of a
look. They're going to find out I'm not human.
Right.
Okay, so let's now our ostensible purpose is to comment on posts on the McLuhan Facebook group, and we somehow miraculously through our ESP can see what they're posting, and therefore we're not excluded from the drama that Alice Kuskus presents. First of all, what is limiting about the form is that Alex is the major poster, and he's reposting his stuff that he featured on his other site, the McLuhan Galaxy, and they're running through cliche statements. So this forum is not a discussion. This forum is a classroom about basic McLuhan. That's what Alex seems to be doing. He's trying to teach basic McLuhan, and he says privately he supports a counter-McLuhan forum somewhere, but not his forum. Or him and his and Martin's form. So,
which is fair, which sounds fair enough.
Sounds fair enough, but the people coming in There's only a couple. One guy came in and said, "Wow, I'm so glad to find you guys. I didn't know about McLuhan, and then I discovered McLuhan the other day, and he's awesome, and explains why the kids are all the same all around the world, and I traveled, and I noticed this and wondered why. So it's a global village." So to me, it's people who are very unfamiliar with the North American hyper-reality world we live in here, the five-bodied world. They're coming from slower cultures, backward cultures. Well, we don't say backward, slower, and they're certainly not like North America. You could say third world cultures. They would find McLuhan useful. So the forum becomes an outreach to people who aren't as sophisticated as the millennials that grew up in North America. Because the millennials in North America wouldn't find anything interesting in McLuhan. What he talks about doesn't exist anymore. Those old media, you know, TV, radio, what's he talking about? It's like Gulliver's Travel, some guy who travels to weird places. TV, the timid giant. Radio, the tribal drum. You know what I mean?
they don't know about that.
And I did notice that some... There are, if you looked when I was allowed in there as a member, a lot of the members were from Eastern Europe. They were from countries, what McLuhan would call the second world and third world. There was not many first world people as members, if you could go by the bio that they presented. You know, maybe it's all fake. But the further removed from North America, the more impressed people are by McLuhan. They learn from McLuhan. That's because they are not living in the 21st century the way... Well, let's say the North American kids live in the 22nd century, and the rest of the world lives in the 20th and 21st century. And that's the way McLuhan used to divide it. He'd say, you know, Quebec is an 18th century country, Canada's a 19th century country, and are up against America, the 20th century country. And he said, Canada could be the 21st century country because it doesn't have an identity, and you won't be able to have an identity, a national identity in the 21st
century. It could also be something like that, you know, here in North America, we're dealing with the new environment, but it's coming hot on the heels of this has been the prime rollout site of all the new environments that this smartphone web 2.0 environment goes all around the world. Maybe it's people in more, you know, second or third world, whatever that means, places, not North America or Western Europe, or basically maybe they are just more able to see the previous environment interacting with the new one, an older environment interacting with the new one, coming in sort of on block all at once. Like the last few new environments are sort of coming in all at once, and they can still see an older one.
Good point.
You know, like you're saying, 19th century.
Yeah, that's what McLuhan said. Marx was able to see the industrial environment because he came from Corsica or someplace that had nothing.
Oh, yeah.
Agrarian places. And so
some African people were able to really use the radio and helicopter because they didn't have any of this roads nonsense.
Right. So the people from a different or older culture, a phase back, do have the advantage of seeing the present because it's so odd to them. It's so different. Whereas those that live in it and grew along with it, they don't notice the changes of the frog being boiled. So, that's a McLuhan point that other cultures can see. Now, maybe that's why Picasso and these guys studied African arts and that. They said, there's something, we need an alien world to see what's happening to our world. Now, the tribalism, McLuhan said, well, no, you guys are becoming like those guys. You're retrieving tribalism. In the early part of the 20th century. So African masks are relevant. That's the name of dance. What was that one? The chaperone or something, the Champlain. Forget the dance in the 20s.
Charleston?
Charleston, yeah, the Charleston. Yeah. So this tribal mask playing, the dithyrambic spectator, McLuhan would see, is what Picasso was trying to talk about, the mask, not the anti-environment point. So, okay, So note, those that are listening who are member allowed in, allowed to participate on the forum, note the sources of the people who post. So not that many people posting, but where are they coming from? What environments are they experiencing? Because it's obvious the North American members of the forum, and there's 1,400 members, they don't have time to be studying McLuhan. They're too busy living the five-bodied life and trying to survive in that situation.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So that's a general point about what I was noticing, the posting. So then I scanned down. Let's see, what was a theme? Oprah. Okay, so back in a few weeks ago, someone thought that Oprah would attract the illiterate, post-literate Americans back to being educated if she was some figure in 60 Minutes or something. Now, this is a crazy idea. Let me see. But, you know, wouldn't call it crazy. What's the figure ground here? Why would someone think that is valuable? What values are they supporting? So it seems that the crowd around this McLuhan Facebook page are POBs. They really believe, and many of them are professors, they really believe there's a role for university education in this Trump world. And they're trying to figure out how to bring that back. And I always thought that McLuhan was explaining how useless that enterprise was unless you turned off the whole matrix.
Right.
You turned it off, you might have a chance. So that McLuhan said it's apocalyptic. I guess, yeah, these teachers, these Alice Kuskas and all, they don't have apocalyptic sensibility enough. They still think
right.
they can preserve something in a world
or
where...
Or that, not even going to require that huge of a critical mass of people thinking about it, interestingly, are going
to
be
turn
able
it
to
around.
Reform it to not be a disaster anymore.
Yeah, to turn it around. If we just get enough informed, educated people who, I don't know, what in media ecology would they learn that would protect everything? There's nothing. Media ecology, at best, gives you a perspective on past dynamics. How does media ecology present something, some kind of critical position? And you see a lot of the humanities, cultural studies, the professors bemoan that the kids don't have critical. They don't have a critical detachment. They want them to become critical, whereas there is nothing but criticism dancing on each other's toes 24/7 in the chip body world.
Yeah, and then again, they are a lot of the kids or whatever are very cynical in terms of being critical of what they hear in the news or from the government or something.
If critique is cynical, that's what Zappa used to say. I'm not cynical. I think that's a good thing to be. You know, he'd say that back in the 70s.
Right.
So these kids are so – well, they got to deal with whether something's real or not. So – I don't see how critical theory, I can see how it would be the last gasp of the POBs in the 80s, which is what Baudrillard, Virilio, and the Cervera-Latrunje gang provided. They were providing a way to be critical. But once Web 1.0 took over and the Android meme became figure, you can't have a critical position. And McLuhan's statement about that under electronic media is accurate. It can be replayed in Andrew Mean situation, but you have to make it a little more complex. It's not that, okay, I am not going to be fooled by the Beatles. I am going to maintain the right to be an author. So praise Margaret Atwood. She kept the novel going despite the orgy of the baby boomers in electronic turn-ons.
And she gave some good sassy back talk to that conservative politician that we all hate.
Yeah. That The Handmaiden's Tale and those horrible Reaganites. And so what is Margaret Atwood going to write? What will the novel be about Trump? I mean, she's exhausted all the apocalyptic or Armageddon fascism takeover worries
about
Reagan.
Well, she could be, if she had already gotten a head start by writing a novel about Ford, Rob Ford, then she would be coming
that's your novel right now,
and it would be perfectly timely.
The great critical theorist, Brian Taylor, is the only one who sees that Trump is replaying Toronto in Bobland through Rob Ford. And not
sure,
only...
Yeah, I mean, that they talk about it a bit. There's been a couple of articles here and there about, you know, it's hard to miss the similarities between Ford and Trump, but it makes people so uncomfortable because it's this phenomenon of like, man, it was horrible when we were watching this thing happen where every scandal about Ford made his poll numbers go up, and oh God, now it's happening again on the national scale in the United States.
Right.
So, this guy's poll numbers won't go down, no matter what he says.
Here's the confusion for Canadians. They have a natural superiority to America. They're glad they're not Americans. And they cannot cite the Brian Taylor thesis because it embarrasses them that we had Trump in the sacred Canada before the states did. How can Canadians have a
before
Trump?
Before the states did. We're used to the American stuff trickling down to like us a little later or something.
Yeah.
You know?
And we became stupid before the Americans did. And how could that be? Because we're smarter than Americans. We hit on a good point of a good comedy skit here. But let me.
Yeah, well, at the time, I was trying to tell people that, like, no, this is such a good, like, Toronto has really done itself proud by the people not just abandoning Rob Ford because, oh, now he's done something embarrassing in the newspapers or something. They're like, no, they have, like, loyalty. They're like, I don't care how horrible it is. I support him. He's good. He fixed my problem as a counselor.
Yeah, I support the fat man. And so here's the Bob aspect. The longest-running member of Club 22, my secret cult, Sue Bones' son, was the last gopher aide of Rob Ford.
Right.
And when
I remember you saying
that. Yeah, and when Brendan Crosscarry, who has a great album out, he's a great musician, the album came out 10 years ago, but look it up, Brendan Crosscarry, C-R-O-S-K-E-R-R-Y. He ends up in Toronto in Ford's second last year, let's say, and one thing leads to another, and he gets the job. And after he quit, at some point when it was all over or getting really bad, he got out of there. I think he quit. And he came on my show and told us some secrets about his life with Rob Ford. Now he could talk because he was no longer Ford's employee. So there was Bob connection, insider connection one. Bob Insider.
That was a very coveted scoop at the time.
Yeah.
People were like, oh boy, do we want to interview the people who are quitting Rob Ford's office right now? My, oh my.
But no, Alice Kuska says Bob can't talk about his life. He can't talk about this. Bob can only talk about McLuhan. And we don't like the way he talks about McLuhan because it's all wrong.
Even if it's not wrong, it's rude.
Yeah. Did you say rude?
Yeah, rude.
Yeah, it's rude and violent. So there's something that could have happened on this McLuhan Facebook thing. Now, the second point is that the attorney general, what do you call them in Canada, the crown attorneys? I forget what you guys call your local prosecuting.
Crown attorneys probably. Yeah.
So my fucking son was the crown attorney leading the investigation into the drug consumption of the Fords.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I thought you had just said he became a judge.
He did.
He was leading or just involved in
prosecution?
No,
he was the lead guy. He's been a lawyer as a fine, youthful member of Club 22. He was a lawyer for 22 years, and he became a judge on February 22nd, 2017.
Yeah.
The 22 is a riddle. Okay, so Paul could not tell people where he worked and what he did. He was in local espionage. They monitored the drug gangs and prosecuted them. And so he was monitoring the gang that was giving stuffed crack to the Fords or to Rob Ford. I don't know about Doug Ford. I won't say that sentence. But anyways, he was investigating that world, and therefore he would have to deal with Rob Ford at some point in there. If it was sort of proven he was buying drugs, right? The video got released, and it's a given.
Yeah.
And did that get released after he died?
Yeah, it ended up getting publicly released.
Yeah, after it didn't matter. So when I was with you in 2014, September 2014, we did a recording with Daniel in the restaurant. But I also met with my son in that period, and he's my foster son. But people like to say, no, no, he's your son. But the point is that he told me his dilemma. Because his aunt was married to Doug Ford, Paul had to recuse, is that the word? Jeff Sessions learned that word, right? Jeff Sessions recently. He had to recuse himself from the investigation of the Fords and this stuff because he knew the media would say, uh-oh, the lead attorney is related to the Fords, could be compromised, corruption here. So he was just getting out of it, I guess, in 2014. He was telling me that he had to, on one level, officially, on the official level, remove himself from his role that he'd been doing for years. And they busted many gangs. And he had to, because what he did, he wasn't allowed to tell anybody what he actually was. So he was in the intelligence world. And this this is a kid who grew up being force-fed Mae Brussels. And he became that world.
Wow.
So there I had, I was on my assistant was defending Ford, that'd be Brendan, and my other assistant was attacking Ford. How's that for Tetra Management in Toronto?
And inside scoops.
Yeah. And, you know, and so then when Paul, you know, he finally, he'd been applying for years to be a judge, and he finally got accepted, but they had to move him up because he knew too much. They had to put him up to a higher level of responsibility. That's what I would tell him personally. You're getting screwed here, Paul. They're sucking you into the establishment. You're going to have to defend the Rob Fords one day because you represent the system. Don't become the system, Paul, I would throw at him. And there's a guy who grew up with a lot of McLuhan thrown at him. You know, and Zappa, and LaRouche, and Mabel.
Yeah, wow, that's good to know he's in the system around here.
Yeah, yeah, he may call on us to help him in the time of unforeseen contrived illusions and fake identities. In the Android meme, not us, in the Android meme. Okay, we're looking at Oprah.
Oprah as educator.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, what would it, why would the hope be in Oprah? I guess because she's been on TV a really long time and she's like, but that's so odd because, like, when they're saying, you know, people haven't had civics courses or something, Oprah is, like, without saying that her influence is in any way negative, Oprah is, like, the archetype of this sort of fuzzy, non-visual education, you know, the life class and all that, like the education that is not content-based, the education that's like how to be interpersonally healthy, basically.
Right. Carol likes to say that if you want to poison somebody, you don't take the poison and think it's going to affect that person. You're going to go. So Oprah's the poison. She, you know, I had a whole, I did this with Roxy the other day. You know how I claim I'm the black woman? I am a black woman. And that black refers to tactility and woman refers to everybody being forced to be right hemisphered. As I was saying it, they said, that's Oprah. I go, oh, yeah, that's right. Oprah is the archetypal electronic Android meme image. She's black. She's tactile and fuzzy. We're not talking about skin color. Black is, McLuhan said, the closest you can visualize tactility because tactility doesn't have a visual component.
And also she is, you know, famously like people have like gone, lived vicariously through her struggles with this or that or she's had traumatic, where she's not just some like, I'm a good host and show you other people, you know. Oprah has also been through the emotional ringer.
Yeah, which is what you have to be. You have to be, to have charisma, you don't look like a lot of other people. You have to go through the shit that everybody else went through. You have to go through the abuse value. And she did that. So she's the right hemisphere environment. So, and she's thinking, the rumor is to think they're going to throw her at Trump, run for president in 2020, you know, Oprah. Okay, so she's totally the present that is threatening our citadels of consciousness. And you say, okay, we have killed a lot of people. They can't think. They can't be critical. They're just zombies of nothingness. And we'll have to take one of them, Oprah, and put them among them so that they will identify with her through the poison media of television and with talk show reality and survive. Can't work. You cannot solve the problem by putting the poison in yourself and claiming you're putting in the other person.
Yeah, no.
The only solution is to turn it off, the whole environment. And that ain't going to happen until a nuclear war happens. That'll knock it out. When the big EMP comes, that'll be McLuhan's finest moment. We'll call it the Neo-Postman aspect of McLuhan. The guy who thinks we're amusing ourselves to death, and we must turn off the media, you know.
That's right, it. Yeah, it's like you talk about this problem, this big dilemma. It's like, are you sure you want to hear the solution? I don't think you're going to like it.
Well, most of us won't survive to see the solution. We will be wiped out during the colossal EMP that's coming, where the whole chip body loses its grounding and therefore is forced to go gardening but has forgotten how to garden. Forgotten how to eat normal food or even to raise it. Doesn't have any animals around. So that's the dire prediction coming out of Club 22. So Richard Dreyfuss says there are tens of millions of adult Americans who have never taken a civics course. Man, it's way more important to understand that you can't have a civics course than to attempt to retrieve it. That's what McLuhan would say.
Right, well, it's interesting because it's like, well, we tried to give people a civics course about jury nullification, and I got run out of town by the police. You know, it's like, the trouble is all of these subjects, it's like they don't want to educate people. Like, it's all a lie.
Yeah.
They're not even looking to solve this problem. If people want it, people are curious about things. When someone explains things well and a real thing, people tune in and listen, and you could do it on TV. The problem is they're like, oh, well, we just want to educate you within the same classic narrow boundaries because we want to know what your reactions are going to be afterwards.
Yeah, yeah. We got to use you for polling purposes or for market focus groups and claim we're not doing it and not doing that. So
teaching people about real civics would be dangerous. The point is people on the internet culture of civics is the conspiracy culture of like hardcore constitutionalists.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. The very people we think are behind Trump and are going to wreck the world. I mean, on some level, Trump is a POB. He wants to bring back visual America.
Right.
And it's not white, it's literate America or some kind of equal fairness within a capitalist situation where people have they know where they are, they have jobs, and they can go to the same place every day and have an identity. It's really interesting. McLuhan always pointed out the confusions among the media ecology set about what the dynamics are here are so revealing about where we're at. We are studying the Media Ecology Association to understand the effects on the poor literate person in this post-literate situation, or a person who's not literate but is hoping to maintain his literate job or to retrieve literate values, is actually disgusting. So here's what I just got. You know how McLuhan cited Wyndham Lewis's it might have been the Code of the Herdsman or some other, maybe it's another manifesto, where you have to, in mid-career, do an about turn and become the opposite of what you were. Do you remember that? It's featured in...
I remember that code of the... I don't remember that line particularly, but...
Okay, that line, it's in Cliché Archetype. McLuhan takes a whole page, quotes it, where Lewis is saying, in mid-career, you must become your opposite of how you presented yourself.
Interesting.
Now, McLuhan did that on the surface. When he was doing Mechanical Bride, proper critical criticism of critical apocalypses advertising.
Right.
And then suddenly he flipped in the 60s and embraced the fucking Armageddon and the apocalypse. The literate critics were outraged.
Mechanical Bride was already a flip from the classical trivium.
That's right, right, right. So people didn't notice that McLuhan because he wasn't, he adopted a different strategy because there was a different media. He still was trying to advocate critical detachment in some way, or some kind of Christian detachment, as he would define it. He, in his early essays, private, small, unpublished essays, he says, my job is to help these damn Catholics catch up to where they are. They're all Protestants and don't know it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
right.
He had a local agenda there to save the Catholic. So He does. He was doing the Lewisian agenda. He became, in his public image, the exact opposite. He embraced the Armageddon and apocalypse. Okay, we need a third flip in McLuhan studies if we're going to carry on the McLuhan meme. We must not celebrate or criticize. We must not use what McLuhan presented himself as in the third phase, because it doesn't apply at all, and you end up acting stupid like the Media College Association. You know, I remember Lance Straight telling once he and Neil Postman, they were asked to consult with some advertising company or something. So what would you tell an advertising company if you just had McLuhanism or a bit of Neil Postman? And this would be 20 years ago, I guess. You'd say, well, you're a hot medium, a cool medium or something. See, the targeting of studying the effects of the audience does not work anymore because the Android meme took over and it's studying itself and its different devices, its different mechanical, what do you call them, machinic parts. The chemical body doesn't apply, and what the chemical body prefers, and you study the chemical body's responses to a product, is not relevant. I don't know if I'm
getting... Yeah, my first thought of, like, the best advice you could give to, like, advertiser people are coming to McLuhan people for consultation on how to advertise. I would think the default answer should be, like, satirize market research or satirize your own, like, behaviorist idea.
Be Steve Colbert. Steve Colbert is a good ad for the American propaganda, for the American way to live. He's got perfect critical detachment, perfect humor. McLuhan used to go on, and this is why it's always good to know everything that McLuhan said, because I've said it to you before, but McLuhanites don't know that McLuhan wrote in the 50s that the deepest value in an American is having a sense of humor.
Yeah.
That's pretty interesting. Most people, well, Americans, think sense of humor is important. They don't know that there's cultures that don't value a sense of humor. How could that be? Who would be like that? Or maybe it would not be blatantly that. It'd be a variation of it or something. I don't know. Sure. But I find it very interesting that McLuhan said Americans are biased. They value a sense of humor. That's a pretty odd statement. But it's useful today because Colbert and Jon Stewart survived and became important because they hoiked up humor, which is that when all is lost in the Armageddon apocalypse of five-bodied life, for the millennials and older people, the core value, the fundamentalism is keep laughing, make us laugh. That makes us vital Americans.
And especially just the laughter being accompanied by and an effect of a deeper understanding of the news. I mean, you could take a news story that in its newspaper version or in its straight-faced TV news version is just very flat, and you have to de-spin it or something politically, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like you have to do all this other work to it if you're not just going to be swallowing some, you know, misleading surface level or something.
Right.
But the Stewart, you know, the Daily Show would be able to present things. They would replay what someone said in a sort of a satirical. Stewart was really good at putting on a funny voice, or like what is the kind of cliche archetype here that this sort of some more corrupt or mob-based or like as if it's an argument among drunks in a Jersey bar rather than politicians in Washington, you know, to like put the human, the kind of Finneganese human archetypal element behind it, and then people understand a lot better because politics is this interpersonal stuff, and this like bickering and fighting, and the news presents every gesture at face value with some dignity that it doesn't deserve, whereas the Jon Stewart presentation of things feels real. It educates people better about the realities of that these are people with psychologies involved in all this. You know, I mean, the civics course is misleading because it pretends that politics is machines of well-designed paper-based infrastructure of, you know,
humanist values.
It's all people. It's all people with an oral code.
Yeah. I was just thinking, this is what's good about knowing rare McLuhan things. You can come up with incredible statements, which I'm known for, in in the radio. I would, if I had to speak before a Doug Reschkoff internet do-yourself hip movement of seriously recovering Wired magazine columnists or something, I would come out and say, the problem with you Americans is that your chief feature is you have a sense of humor. This is incredible provincial fundamentalism. And, you know,
right,
say something
yeah.
like that. I would never think to say that unless I read McLuhan. But that would be that would have the effect McLuhan had. That should puzzle people. What the fuck is Bob on about? A sense of humor is important. I won't fuck you unless you got a sense of humor, buddy. You know? And you start saying that's a problem. And so there's where Neil Postman didn't understand why Americans were amusing themselves to death. It was they weren't being un-American. They were being American. They must keep laughing.
Right.
That's a new – isn't that a new angle on Postman?
It could be because, I mean, that definitely gets at the ambiguity. And, I mean, like, I would hope that – whatever, never mind the people on the list. I just – the idea of this whole thing about denigrating TV or something, but, you know, on the other hand, the Daily Show type of thing was better news than other news precisely because of its TV values – you know, that's a big ambiguity
yeah.
and limitation of Postman.
Right. So Postman is asking Americans to become un-American, which is typical of a New York lefty intellectual. They all are not. New York, as McLuhan said, is not an American city. So we get
right,
a lot.
Right, yeah. It's like, stop with all the guns and the stop with the everything that makes you uniquely, proudly American, please.
Yeah,
can,
yeah.
can you just be like the, you know, blander other democracies in the world?
Yeah,
not so much character.
Get rid of your car and start taking cabs. Yellow taxi, preferably, or do the subway. And, you know, McLuhan had a great statement with that about how public transit, he said this about 1974, public transit will not work in America because Americans go out to be alone. And they're not
yeah.
going to be like Japanese and all be pushed into a, you know, some underground subway thing, you know, packed in like sardines. Like, that's not going to happen. So all these Jane Jacobs in New York City trying to redesign cities and stop the Spadina Expressway has no clue about the media ground. And yet the New Yorkers celebrate Jane Jacobs. They probably have an institution named after her, you know. You know about her, the city's historian?
Yeah, oh, totally. Oh, yeah,
yeah,
well, she spent a lot of time in Toronto, so she's
well-known, yes.
Here.
Well, Torontonians, they probably could put up a monument to her like they did with Jack Layton.
Oh, I think that they have put up a monument to her. She lived here for a long time.
Yeah, now that makes sense. That, see, Canadians don't understand their visual bias. And they don't understand how they're kind of oral and southern, American southern, compared to mainstream America. And McLuhan wrote an essay on that. The Canadian is really much like the American South mentality.
Yeah.
And he goes into it, but without going into that. So Canadians don't know who they are and what they are and what they represent. And so, you like McLuhan said things that people thought were nuts. You know what I mean? That's what you have to realize.
Yeah, that one makes no sense. Well, yeah, and the latest biography is totally right, supporting this idea that, like, well, McLuhan was really great, even though, you know, lots of that later stuff was probably just stroke farts from his broken brain.
Yeah, what's the guy? You're talking about Copeland's biography.
Yeah, Copeland.
Yeah, stroke farts from his broken brain. Jeez, that, you
yeah.
can do a post on that, man. That's a good title.
Well, that's what's in the bio, basically.
That's right.
That's what, yeah. It's like, well, yeah, that's one way of giving up on trying to understand the stuff in Take Today.
All these books that attempt, from Marshawn on, attempt to understand McLuhan, you have to really deeply get McLuhan and Finney's Wake and all the background, not I.A. Richards and this and that you try not Wyndham Lewis. You have to understand how McLuhan was a total original, a disconnect from whatever was going on. And you can become that if you do the work, because McLuhan spells it out. If you take the time, you can get it. Then you would understand what McLuhan was. So none of these guys take the time to...
Right. Well, I mean, McLuhan, you know, if you're going to... It would be an interesting study to go through everything McLuhan wrote, good luck, and come up with everywhere where he says something about the background you need to understand what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, maybe he mentions Innes or I.A. Richard, Leavis and Richard
no,
to the crowd.
No, he doesn't mention them.
It's all about Finnegan's Wake and the Symbolists.
And the Vortices. Pound,
right.
Elliot Joyce, the guys on my chart. You have to study them, and the figure.
Poets,
yes.
Not theorists and critics.
Not
poets.
Biology, not neuroscience, though McLuhan included that. And what was interesting about McLuhan, he said, well, the brain research is going this way because of the ground. The deeper science is the causes why science goes from quantum to string theory. To understand why they make a shift to another contrived illusion called string theory is to understand the media environment making scientists go in that direction. That's that's McLuhan's understanding. He looked at any phenomenon and said, well, this is – and there's a quote we went
– And just even asking what is that direction in a formal sense.
And how does it match the present bias of the media dynamic that's not noticed? There's a quote he once said, well, I'm just sitting here in the Cochos watching projects that people propose. So everybody would propose, every discipline, psychiatry to sports, would advocate a new stadium or a new kind of psychiatry, a new something, a new project. We must have education reform. He would study the impulse to reform your profession and the bias that you're thinking you want to move towards is already happening in the environment around you. Now, I don't know many people have said that statement. You could type that one up, but he was looking at whatever he really was. You know, when I sat in Eric's class in 1978 into 79 at the Ontario Art College, there was a homeless guy sitting in front of the gallery, the Ontario, what is it called? The AGO? I forget.
That's right there.
Art Gallery
of
Ontario.
Yep.
The big place there. And the school was right beside it, attached to it. So the students would laugh about this homeless guy sitting there every day just eating and shitting and stuff. And so Eric says, maybe his first time he'd heard about it, but I was there to witness it. He says, you know what that guy is? Is that homeless guy you're making fun of? No, what is he? He's a Manipian satirist. What's that?
Huh, really?
Yeah. Well, what? What is that? And so then he proceeded to explain Manipian satire. So
nice.
McLuhan is a homeless guy sitting in his coach house on the fringe of the campus, shitting, farting, and making fun of any human that walks by with a crazy agenda.
Making fun of any human that walks by.
Because that's what he said. I study whatever projects are presented to us. You know, we study the effects of the delusion of your project.
That's interesting.
Yeah, that's a good story. I forgot that one.
Well, I mean,
think of that. And I used to see the guy. And so, Eric forever burned in my mind that guy as a Manipian satirist. That was my image. Because remember, according to Eric's thesis, the philosophy or anti-philosophy of cynicism comes from Diogenes, and he was a homeless guy walking around just wearing a barrel.
Right.
Looking for an honest
man. And he was serious about that, that virtue or something or that. Not exactly an asceticism, but just a...
He called it an honest man.
Screw you, everything, like...
Right, the story is, in English, it passed honest. He was looking for an honest man, but if you go back and read the Greek, it's probably some other polysemic, other kind of meaning in Greek terms, you know what I mean? But we've watered it down to honest man. He was probably looking for a genuine Manipian satirist. Not an honest man. You know that honesty is a product of the printing press? You ever read McLuhan on that? That's in the Gutenberg Galaxy. Because pre-printing press, everybody expected everybody to be a hypocrite, a put-on artist. And Roxy pointed out to me, she was looking into aristocracies and castles and stuff, and she said, in Louis XIV's court, if you could not be almost a comedian, you could. It didn't matter what you did or what you were or what, you had to be entertaining. In the constant salons and talk and gossip world, if you could not talk a good story, you were out. You know what I mean? So you had to be a verbal entertainer and be witty and make up shit and all that. That's what you had to be to survive at the court. That's an oral culture.
It's an endless dinner party. So.
Yeah, but they do not want honesty. That's basically want lying. And so what's interesting is Trump has hijacked the lying position, and because he's this the private citizen of consciousness, the individual, the leader of visual space and individual Sumerian culture, he's outside the matrix. He can say, you're all lying, because he's got the citizen of consciousness position, the White House. I mean, it is crazy that everything has to go to one guy who makes the final decision. You know what I mean? That's our culture.
It's the pyramid.
Yeah, the pyramid with one person at the top, and it all depends on what his decision is. Whereas, you know, oral culture is not as group committee. It was committee realities. And McLuhan said corporate life by the 60s was taken over by committee, government by committee, he said. But we have to create the fraud or the fundamentalist bias of an individualist culture. That's our heritage built on the printing press. So we must have a president. The position is totally symptomatic of American culture. It tells us what we are. Nothing to do with, you know, research, changing the world, bringing peace or famine or World War II. It's about the hoiking up the myth of the individual. And your integrity and your mind has to know everything so that you can make the ultimate decision. Because you are the person that got into the place where you have to hit the button or not. So they actually show it in their objection to Trump. We can't have a nut like that with his finger on the button. Who really believes that the president would have his finger on the button? Actual fact, there's so many.
Well, it was interesting. There was I came across, like, they had to sort of specifically combat this notion or something that there was an idea going around that people were seemingly thinking, like, oh, they would never, you know, they don't just let some lunatic president on a whim launch a new, like, they're not going to let. And, like, a bunch of articles came out that are like, no, it is the whole system is specifically designed so that only the president can make or revoke that order. You know, they do drills all the time where they don't know if they're putting through the real order or not, you know?
Right.
And, like, there's nowhere in the chain of command that where they're like, well, let's just stop and rethink about this or something. Like, they tried to come out with this whole thing that, like, unlike any other war situation where you imagine all this drama between the Joint Chiefs and the blah, 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 that the nuclear thing really is just the president's whim.
So what the deep state means is that is never the case. There's so many factions watching another faction. So you have a faction that's going to cancel a crazy president, but they got another faction watching that secondary faction watching the president. It's so safeguarded multiple times by guys watching this stuff because they're not going to let one person have the decision. You know what I mean? But it's a cultural delusion or user's content bias that we insist that it is up to one guy. That's the only way.
Yeah, that there's a button and there's a finger that rests against that button, and that's just, that's like a mythic gestalt complex that you can't get rid of.
It's an American Western meme. The individual's meme, it's an after image of the Gutenberg effect.
Yeah, so, it's an individualist meme.
And, you know, Norm Mailer, who was an interesting media ecologist, he said in the late 70s, he started to say, as he was losing his popularity, he said, you know, I've realized that the one thing Americans are really concerned about is virtue, whether they're virtuous or not. And he goes on about that. But I would see that as being a clean, honest, literate person, virtuous. And all education is designed to make your kids and other kids in the neighborhood be virtue, be this literate thing capable of being the guy with the finger on the button. Or the woman to handle that, and that's and that is not the way life is led at all today, or experienced or lived. So that is why the White House can become more and more the pulpit of a nut. Each president gets stupider and crazier and weirder or not predicted because it's irrelevant. Nobody in the White House is going to have any say about anything. But you do need it. But it is the heart of the theater of the American meme speaking back to itself. It must hoik up the individualist thing. That used to be a big deal in education. You know, what would you if you were president? You know, are you ready to become president? You know, you're going to be all on your shoulders. And then the other myth is that goes along with that is that every president ages. Like Obama, he had wonderful hair, but within 4 years he had white hair, you know, because of the strength of being a superior individual. So what is McLuhan? So McLuhan says back in 72, the president is a automated presidential surrogate. In other words, the president is not really the guy with the finger on the button. Is a superlative nobody. That's somebody with virtue. But we've gotten more extreme versions of nobody becoming the
president. Because you don't want someone with tons of character. That's the idea. Like Trump is a nut because he's got all this character. That's not like your character is supposed to you're supposed to be a nobody whose character is formed out of, you know, vast blocks of special interests or positions on opinions or something or a political ideology or you know, it's not supposed to be your character. You're not supposed to be the more character is in there, the more friction or something.
Yeah, you can't be an eccentric. You have to be someone. And McLuhan even wrote that. There's one sentence in Cultures Are Business. He says, why are politicians always out of touch? It's because they have to work their way through the Big Brother establishment, the historical power nexuses that were there for 150 years. Maybe you could say the Freemasons. You have to get and know that world. And then by the time you've understood everybody in the secret societies of Big Brother, you're then totally out of touch with what the people are experiencing. So he explained the reason the president would be out of touch, I mean that's back in the 60s, is that they would spend too much time making the, what Zappa said when he was thinking of running president, to go through the Byzantine bureaucracy of making the connections of the real levers of decision making to and pass their test, pass their scrutiny, their vetting. So, and so then you have that echoed in the cabinet. Every cabinet position must be vetted. That's looking for the sane, as McLuhan would say, well-adjusted person. And the well-adjusted person is a somnambulist, but he's really good at schmoozing and whatever you do, like Nixon did to become president. You know what I mean? He knew the right law in the New York law firms to know. Now,
and doing a bunch of dirty favors for people,
right? And interfacing with the mafia and that who ran the local politics of cities and that the obsolete cities. That's the way it was. But you could say by the disappearance of the Planet of the Dead in the late 70s, then it was totally the android meme. Then the first unqualified person became president, Reagan. How could an actor, he hasn't been doing the work, you know, he hasn't been spending his time in New York with the right law firms and interfacing with mafia gangs and being a district attorney, busting the local mafia like Giuliani or something. You've been a frivolous guy making fake movies, you know, for contrived illusions. So ever since then, there was that integrity factor is not there. Everybody was a dark horse bypassing the traditional chemical body connections to become the legitimate president.
Right. I guess it makes sense, too, why, I mean, there is some sort of people are sensing in various ways that we are sort of, we're like retrieving the early 80s now somehow. But so I guess that would be part of that is we're being reminded of when we broke into the this silent sea of the actor president.
So on the day Reagan got elected, I was the day after. Yeah, the day after the election. So that would be 1980, November 6th or something. I was at Dave Wally's house. Now, he was the first biographer of Zappa. And he was an old 60s radical with not the SDS, but he wrote for Walter Boer's East Village Other, and he knew everybody in the radical scene of the 60s, the serious intellectuals, the ones with integrity who went to Canada or dropped out or did not participate in corrupt America. So that was Dave Wally. And I was in the other room while he had to take a call. So pretty quickly on the phone, I heard him saying, yeah, I think we're going to have to take out our old, and he named some kind of street uniform or jacket or clothing that you wear in protests. You know what I mean?
Right.
So he said, so Reagan had become president, and immediately the 60s baby boomers had to start protesting
and
objecting to the image of Reagan. And so I keep thinking of that when they say that the anti-Trump is like the ferocity of anti-Reagan. The shock of Reagan becoming president is Trump is replaying. So I keep thinking of the Dave Wally effect. And millions of people are doing that now, not just Dave Wally and a couple of guys in the East Village.
You're right.
You've got whole species doing it, the species of women, the
right.
species of black people, Americans protesting it. So it's quadrupled the Reagan theme. So if you cite Reagan, we're retrieving the 80s. This is another thing that people don't understand. That's 2 million years ago. That's when there was a TV. It wasn't even a TV body. It was a TV landscape, and it was peaking with
right.
his image. It was the end of the TV iconography. But when you got multiple bodies where we are now, there's no historical precedent to talk about Trump. Because we're actually in
right.
a new scene. So if we don't understand the media environment we're in and its subsumption into a post-Android meme weirdness, that's updating McLuhan, then you don't know what Trump is. And you wouldn't understand why people can't categorize Trump. They couldn't categorize Obama. They failed on that. He was the mystery guy, the first mystery guy. And so in flailing around to find something bad in his background, they had to start saying, oh, he was born in Indonesia or something. And I'm not saying that he wasn't born there, but the thing is, the grappling for an image, where have they gotten with Trump? Just that he's disgusting. Barbara Streisand
right.
announced the other day that she's gaining weight and becoming fat because every day she would normally have juices for a slim juice breakfast, one that where she wouldn't gain weight. But she's so disturbed by the new interior decoration in her room, namely Trump, that she eats big chunks of pancakes and maple syrup. Because
wow.
she has to drown her dissatisfaction, what the interior decorator did to her room, that she's gaining weight. But isn't it
and maple syrup too?
Yeah, there's the that's like I'm leaving and going to Canada. Well, I'm not going
right,
to Canada,
exactly.
but I'm going to eat their maple syrup.
And wishing I was in Canada.
Yeah, living the Canadian life.
Yeah, tapping the trees for maple syrup.
What'd you say? Sapping.
Tapping the trees for maple syrup in my Canadian cottage.
Okay, so guess what? Did you hear the latest scam out of Canada, out of the Prime Minister's office?
Oh, maybe not. Oh, wait. Is it that our foreign affairs minister's uncle was a Nazi newspaper publisher?
No. The first lady, what do you call the wife of the prime minister? The first, is she called
first
lady?
Oh, she, no, they don't say first lady. I think they just say
the wife
of the prime minister, I guess.
The wife of the prime minister on International Women's Day, which is an important day in my life, because that's
right. She was like, let's celebrate men.
Yeah. And now, that's an important day. I always remember that because that was the day in March 8, 1991, that I was informed by the Lesbian Caucus of CKLN that I was no longer allowed to do my services. But it was under the cover of, well, you can't do your show today, Bob, because no men allowed on the radio today. It's Women's Day. So that's how they started to remove me with that alibi. So I always remember the date. It was a traumatic day.
Oh, wait, that was yesterday. It was International Women's Day.
Yeah.
Right?
That's
oh, well, that's that's nice then that it was the panel of the Videodrome Salon was three women. So.
Ah, okay. Fit.
They didn't mention that. That's cooler than if they had mentioned it.
Yeah. So she the reaction, there were top, I don't know, women, feminists saying, I am at a loss of how to respond. This is shocking.
Right.
And more interior decoration inappropriately slathered on their walls by this person living in their Android meme global membrane space known as Mrs. Trudeau, who made a big faux pas. But it was an interesting statement. You know, that she did that. What did she, what value?
Definitely. I liked it. I heard about that and I thought, you know, that's a fair point. I mean, it's totally understandable the way that you would say, like, boy, are you not getting the point today? But it's appropriate for someone in her position to do that, I think, especially because, you know, the idea about Trudeau is that he's this wonderfully feminist prime minister with the He made sure that his cabinet was had gender parity and all that.
Right.
So
hey,
for her,
realized.
I mean, if it was the wife of a conservative prime minister, they would be even more pissed off.
Right.
Or maybe they're even more pissed off at her because, no, the Trudeaus, you're not supposed to offend us that way.
Right. And so in other words, Trudeau's a feminist and his wife's a male chauvinist. Trust Canada to one-up America. This is our new perverted leadership is trying to counter the Trump image.
Yeah.
Because the whole point is to get attention. You got to do something to get attention. That's the new art form.
Right.
You got to get
coverage. Trudeau is going to be, I don't know how much attention you'll get, but you know, Trudeau is going to be in New York next week for there's a musical comedy about 9/11 in Newfoundland where they like diverted all the flights.
Yes.
There's a musical comedy about September 11th premiering in New York next week, and Trudeau's going to be there for that.
Yeah, based on the Newfoundland experience on 9/11.
Yeah.
Okay, in Labrador, I think it was. I remember that. Goose Bay, Labrador, maybe, was where they all
Gander.
Landed. Oh, Gander, right, Gander. Is that Gander in Labrador or in Newfoundland?
I think it's just Newfoundland.
Okay. I want to get back to the posting. So there's this statement about Oprah, and this was posted by Alexander Christus. And he's quoting the article, "The media age has blurred the line between politics and entertainment. The venerable media scholar Marshall McLuhan foresaw this phenomenon in 1969 when he told an interview, quote, TV is revolutionizing every political system in the Western world. For one thing, it's creating a totally new type of national leader. Through radio, TV, and the computer," the millennial goes, "What's that?" Looks up Google's radio, and they have a picture. Oh, that's radio. What's TV? What's a computer? They won't know what these words. But anyways, McLuhan said 50 years ago, "Through radio, TV, and the computer, we are already entering a global theater." What would be a theater? What's that? The millennial has to look up theater. "We are already entering a global theater in which the entire world is a happening." Then the millennial go, "Happening." Oh, that's a 60s word. That's Andy Warhol. Okay, so McLuhan say through these weird old technologies, we're entering some place which is Andy Warhol. Well, that's pretty hip. I like Warhol. So I'm just that's how the millennial would interpret this paragraph. And then the article guy, the journalist, after quoting McLuhan, says, "More hype is not needed, nor are more tweets or rambling public appearances. As actor Richard Dreyfuss has noted, there are tens of millions of adult Americans who have never taken a civics course. A reformed educational system can teach them, as can a vigilant press media. But if an appealing and grounded celebrity were to continue Oprah Winfrey's legacy of explaining complex issues to mainstream Americans, it would help." Well, now,
that's what John Oliver supposedly does. Like, this article should immediately be saying, like, now John Oliver has been celebrated recently for doing exactly this. Do we just need more of that, or do we tweak his formula? You know, it's like he was on The Daily Show, John Oliver, and then he got his own show where he does a sort of a jokey style, a Daily Show style breakdown, but instead of just only having the amount of time between one set of commercials to talk about something, they do a long
he conducts a seminar
about one topic.
He could do a seminar.
He's been celebrated for explaining complicated topics. Exactly that.
Oh, but it has to be funny, right?
Right. But the topic doesn't necessarily have to be funny. Some of the topics
have been,
you know, arcane things about insurance, whatever, that's scamming people or something.
Okay. So this person gives in to the TV landscape and Oprah. You see, why did Oprah quit? She knew she was obsolete. She knew that nobody was paying attention to her kind of broadcast anymore. That was like 5 years ago, I guess, she started to quit. That's why other people in news quit. I can't remember their names. A whole bunch of people have quit over the last few years. And they recognize that educational or instructive media with messages or news doesn't apply anymore. So Oprah is, I guess, been floundering about, and she just lives up the street from us once a year. She comes here to Maui Meadows, and the rumor is that she demands a new set of furniture every year when she comes. So her place up on the side of the mountain, an isolated place. She's the ivory tower of the individual. She has a huge landscape that nothing else is around. She was able to buy a huge thing from the farmers who weren't selling to anybody. But so she's got her ivory tower up there, and she's wondering, what do I do next to keep myself viable? As Zappa said, the only thing is media. You got to be in the media somehow. But now everybody's making their own media, so a centralized image doesn't work. So where is she going to go? To that, is it an albatross, an ancient institution, 60 Minutes, which I have not watched in 25, 30 years because it's too slow
right.
and stupid. And so she has to go back to the TV landscape, which will be a failed mission.
Right, well, and the idea, the supposed, you know, relevance of a 60 Minutes type of institution that's going to do something that, you know, your typical or what she was doing before wouldn't do, or what regular news wouldn't do, is this idea that they do investigative journalism, like that they're like, you know, hardened beat reporters type
yes.
of thing, uncovering scandal, but
they're going to find
TV
the dishonest
format.
Person, the un-American dishonest person who's lying. And,
right.
That's
so it's like, so, okay, are you going to make a show where you're, because that's the thing, people have an endless taste for this uprooting the conspiracy and the corrupt people.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just I just come back to this fake dilemma of like, oh, people not being educated, you don't want to educate them. Like, you don't want them to know how bad things really are, like, and they will respond to the truth of that stuff, but, like, you just mean educate them to be that you just wanted them to vote for the Democrat. Now you just want to create an audience that'll vote for the Democrat. That's all it means when they say educate.
Yeah, and the workers recognize that. That's what they're
yeah.
against.
Yeah, so they're never going to buy it.
Yeah, they're not going to. Any effort to reach out to them ain't going to work.
So
Alex posts this with no comment. And I'll give you a comment that sums up what you were just saying that McLuhan said. He said in the late 70s in this, I think it's an unpublished interview that I have, he says, I know of no politician who is not involved in conflict of interest.
Right.
You cannot be a politician of integrity because there's too many environments, too much overlay, and too much global membrane and non-national involvements by every environment and business that's going on, that you can't be local and follow the Constitution or whatever the Canada's rules are. And it's a pretty
right.
important, you know, back in 70s when people were shocked at whatever Nixon meant, you know, conflict of interest or something. And then if you said right then, well, nobody can be beyond conflict of interest, that would shock people. Oh, what do you mean?
Yeah.
That's our deciding of who we vote for. Who doesn't have
conflict? Yeah, they wouldn't want to believe that.
They wouldn't believe it. They wouldn't understand it. But now it's more obvious. But Alexander Kuskis doesn't know that, so he doesn't make the forum interesting.
He just doesn't clarify anything about, like, okay, well, so wait, was Obama great or something? Or are we talking about, like, this whole thing about, like, people not being educated enough and responding too much to emotional something, or they're not the elites and they want to just fast-forward themselves to the elite position without doing the hard work or something? It's like, wait, are you talking about not just the whole Trump thing, but you're talking about the Sanders thing too, aren't you? You're just talking about the people that ruined the party you were going to have this time is all you really, the people with their naive ideas about, and they don't know how the world really works and they just want it all. And he promises the moon, this guy who's not completely entrenched in conflict of interest. He's a bit independent, and all of these naive people who think that the guy who's slightly more independent is going to be able to be president. Like, to me, it seems like that when they're, you know, like, that there was, the point is there was the movement of people to stop the Trump thing, if that's the most important thing. There were lots of people who were really motivated to have a more policy-driven, civics-minded, participatory, blah, 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 and they got screwed over by the party they wanted to support. So are you going to deal with that or not?
Like, right, right.
It's so disingenuous. It's not, I mean, in addition to fundamentally misunderstood, being inappropriate for a McLuhan list and being forlorn and all that, it's just totally disingenuous.
Right, right. It's
there
bad,
isn't really that problem.
It's bad scholarship, bad education. Frank Zingroni wrote a review of the McLuhan World after McLuhan left, and he said a bunch of posers in baggy pants is what he called the kind of people that we're seeing on the list here. And so basically, what Alex has created is a fan magazine. And they're just citing the greatest hits of the old themes, and whenever their rock star got mentioned in the media, they're not providing any criticism. And when they do, they get into their personal point of view and don't cite really interesting McLuhan points that would throw light on the bias of the article they're citing. Because
it's a problem. Like I'd say, without the commentary on those articles, it's harmful to share them. If you're trying to do the outreach to people, especially if they're not like English isn't their first language or whatever, like what the idea that they want the list to be, apparently, that's not good. To just let you want to learn about McLuhan? Well, here, have a bunch of unexamined assumptions from people who know as little about McLuhan as possible, but it got published, so here. But it contributes to this completely inane and wrong and vague notion of McLuhan, and there's no corrective. That's a bad influence.
And that's why we had to create this audio.
Yeah, that's why we had to create this audio. You can't. We care too much about McLuhan to just let that happen.
Waste it on the fans. And I'm called. I think when Lance Strait calls me Lunatic Fringe, we're fanatics. We're McLuhan fanatics. We emphasize McLuhan too much. We don't know our Jacques Lowell and Harold Innes or some other Susan Langer or some failed media colleges enough. No, we're not fans of McLuhan. We just recognize that nobody heard what he had to say. Not what
you
think.
Well, I'm a fan of McLuhan. But yeah, okay, I get you.
No, we're not. I'm not here to do a fan magazine. That's what Alex is doing. They're just saying, look, maybe McLuhan will be brought back. Maybe we'll get funding and the coach house will continue if we just show that people are quoting McLuhan down there in the American press. You know, maybe the mayor of Toronto will put a statue up to McLuhan.
Right.
So that what you just said was a good summary of why we're doing this. And we're not trying to be venomous or castigate people personally, but I am criticizing them intellectually. The way they failed to criticize me, they didn't criticize me intellectually. They claimed I was a baggy pants poser.
Right.
And if anybody isn't, it's me. I don't tell you, listeners, all through the last 30 years, the incredible numbers of people saying, you're McLuhan. You're the new McLuhan. And, you know, I can create that effect, including leading to the last guy to do incredible work with McLuhan that unfortunately never got done, which was the TV series that David Greenberg was going to do, who lives here in Maui. When he met me in 2008 through Mary McLuhan, after a couple of dates with me, he says, you know, you remind me so much of McLuhan. You're McLuhan. Why don't we put on a one-man show at the Maui Cultural Center where you come out and be McLuhan? That's what he proposed to me. And it never happened. He got distracted, hijacked by China. He became the token. This is in the summer of 2008, and the Olympics are coming up. He was hired by the Chinese government, the committee over there, to be the representative ecologist saying that China was being ecological to counter the scandal that was looming, that it was a polluted city, you know, the Olympic center and all that stuff. So David ended up working in China. So he disappeared from being around Maui to put on the McLuhan replay with yours truly.
Yeah.
But I wasn't into doing it that much anyways. But anyways, I'm just telling you people, I'm the only person out there. You know what Lance Strait said after the performance on March 28, 1998, the Lincoln Center, the famous McLuhan Symposium? I finished doing my bit, and then Lance told me at one point, he says, Jesus, sound like you were channeling McLuhan. Which I took as a compliment, that I sounded like McLuhan or the effect of McLuhan. So that is only natural that I would be ostracized just like McLuhan was.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But I'm not Oscar.
Yeah, I mean, you've got, it's not just the resemblance. You've got the you got an analogical. You're in the analogical situation that way. And
the mirror.
Understandings.
Yeah, and so, and I have a bigger audience than those guys. Anyways, I have a global audience, so I'm doing them a favor by dropping into their little nano community to offer a few tidbits from the old archive.
But, great. Well, yeah. I mean, you. Okay. What are you going to go with? Google Alert articles or great quotes out of the archives?
Yeah, that we never heard of, that McLuhan said. And great anecdotes, because I actually knew the guy. You didn't. Not you, but the audience. So so thank you, Brian, for digging what we do here, what I do, so that we can at least have two of us. You know, we're like Ken Kesey and Paul Krasner. We went through the madness. We had our experience from Toronto as the hidden signature. So
right.
That we could surface now after the incredible destruction of the Android meme by Messer Trump, or Trumpelstiltskin.
Yeah, or trampling on the body of the meme.
Yeah, yeah, that's what he's doing. Okay, good. So
yeah, great, thanks. Good fun time. Good, yep.
You know,
talk, good talk.
Yeah, Scott Woods told me the other day. If you listen to our Scott Woods, Dave Neufeld.
That was really good. I liked that. I listened to that whole thing.
Yeah, was it recorded where Scott said he went to a few, because he lives in Toronto, a few of the salon, McLuhan salon events?
Oh,
maybe it didn't get
maybe
recorded.
Maybe not. I don't remember.
Here's
that.
What he said after we stopped recording. He said, you know, Bob, I've been to a few McLuhan salon. He's very interested in McLuhan. He actually has a very good archive on obscure mentions of McLuhan in all media. You ever seen that, this McLuhan sandbox? It's listed on Alex.
Oh, McLuhan. Right, yeah. I've been once, so I haven't been there recently, but yeah.
He cites every obscure Rolling Stone, McLuhan mentioned in Rolling Stone magazine.
Yeah.
He's got an incredible archive. So he's been to a few McLuhan salons, and he told me the other day that it is so dull, so ineffectual, that he goes home and finds an old Bob McLuhan rant and listens to that to get something out of the evening.
I did hear that. That was on there.
Yeah,
right.
That he goes home and takes a hit of Bob to get a sense of what he was looking for in the McLuhan salon, and it wasn't there.
Yeah.
That's one of my best compliments.
Yeah,
so,
and it's unfortunate. There just aren't a lot of people out there that know enough about McLuhan to relate their other expertise to him. It's unfortunate.
But McLuhan said that Wyndham Lewis would never get mass appeal. That kind of manipulative satirist, or whatever he was back then, cannot appeal to the general public. So McLuhan knew he'd have that fate, too. That would be the real Wyndham Lewis and the real McLuhan, not the Wyndham Lewis, the guy who voted for Hitler, you know, that image.
Right.
Or the McLuhan, the guy who thought we'd have a peaceful global village. And how wrong was that?
Which, hey, how about that? Like, how about challenge the friggin'... You know what I mean? What they should be doing on that list is collectively reading Wyndham Lewis's Hitler.
Yeah.
Like, man, I read that online, and it's like, wow, you all, anybody who's serious about this Trump being Hitler thing should really read that book and see the similarities and differences between the way he was describing 30s Germany and these days.
You just made me a prophet. 2 years ago, did you know on Payday, on my weekend show, I read page one at the end, Hitler by Wyndham Lewis?
And you mentioned that recently, and I was thinking of going to go listening to that, but then I found a place online where they had like scanned every page, and so I just read it that way.
Right. Well, what you might want to do is listen to me and my colleagues on there discussing it. We have a little dialogue about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is even better.
Definitely.
So we're telling you.
Well, relating it to the present, for sure.
Right. So your homework, listeners, is to go listen to Ian and go to ianandbob.com and put in the search for Bob Does Hitler and listen to the discussion to prepare for our next broadcast when we review whatever posts are going to be posted by the few people that post in Alex Kuska's personal blog called McLuhan or something, Facebook forum.
Yeah.
All right. I think we have offered enough anti-environmental vibrations to call it a evening.
I think so, too.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Brian.
Cool.
Okay.
Talk to you soon.
Yep.
Toodaloo.